Chaturanga Gaura Hari Bol. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskrityam Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato jaya mudiraye nashta prayeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttama shloke bhaktir bhavati naishtaki. So we're reading today from the 11th canto, chapter 2, text 49, chapter entitled Maharaj Nimi Meets the Nine Yogendras. So we're doing the third part of the purport today. So let's read the text. Let's read the verse, sorry.
Dehendriya prana mano diyam yo janma pyayakshut bayaktar shakrachre samsara dharme ravimuya manaha Smritya Harer Bhagavata Pradana Dehendriya Prana Mano Diyam Yo Janma Pyayakshut Bayatar Shakrachre Samsara dharme ravimuyamanaha Smritya harer bhagavata pradanaha Dehendriya prana mano diyam yo Janma pyayakshut bayaktar shakrachre Samsara dharme ravimuyamanaha Smritya harer bhagavata pradanaha Janma pyayakshut bayaktar shakrachre Samsara dharme ravimuyamanaha Smritya harer bhagavata pradanaha Dehendriya prana mano diyam yo Krichre Samsara dharme ravimuyamanaha
Smritya Hare Bhagavata Pradhanaha. Matajis? Word-to-word translation. Deha, of the body. Indriya, senses. Prana, life air. Manaha, mind. Diyam, and intelligence. Yaha, who? Janma, by birth. Apyaya, diminution. Kshut, hunger. Baya, fear. Tarsha, thirst. Krichre, and the pain of exertion. Samsara, of material life. Dharme, by the inseparable features. Avimuyamanaha, not bewildered. Smritya, because of remembrance. Hare, of Lord Hari. Bhagavata Pradhanaha, the foremost of devotees. Translation by the disciples of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Within the material world, one's material body is always subject to birth and decay. Similarly, the life air, prana, is harassed by hunger and thirst. The mind is always anxious. The intelligence hankers for that which cannot be obtained. And all of the senses are ultimately exhausted by the constant struggle in the material nature. A person who is not bewildered by the inevitable miseries of material existence and who remains aloof from them simply by remembering the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is to be considered Bhagavat Pradhana, the foremost devotee of the Lord. Purport by disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. So we'll read the third part of the purport. The demons are self-proclaimed enemies of the Supreme Lord, and they mock His kingdom. Thus they are described by Srila Madhavacharya as Ado Gatehe, or those who have purchased their tickets to the darkest regions of hell. On the other hand, if one is undisturbed by the miseries of material life, he is on the same spiritual level as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 2.15, Yam hi avyatante purusham purushar sabha samadukka sukam dhiram so martyatvaya kalpate. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by the happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. One can come to this transcendental stage only by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the words of Sri Madhavacharya, Sampurna nu grahad Vishnu. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has described the process by which one becomes an Uttama Adhikari. If one is fortunate, he gradually becomes disgusted with the limited vision and activities of the Kanishta Adhikari and learns to appreciate the expanded vision of the Madhyama Adhikari, who is able to recognize that every living entity should become a devotee of Krishna and that one achieves the perfection of life by following in the footsteps of an Uttama Adhikari, devotee of the Lord. As one's devotional service gradually intensifies and one repeatedly bathes in the dust of the lotus feet of a pure devotee, the harassment of birth, death, hunger, thirst, fear, and so on gradually cease disturbing the mind. As stated in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.2.114, Alabdeva vinasteva bhaksha chadana sadhane aviklava matir bhutva harim eva diasmaret. Even if a devotee is frustrated in his attempt to eat properly or clothe himself properly, he should not allow this material failure to disturb his mind. Rather, he should use his intelligence to remember his master, Lord Sri Krishna, and thus remain undisturbed. As one becomes mature in this process of remembering Krishna in all circumstances, he is awarded the title Mahabhagavat. So Bhaktisiddhanta gives the example that just as a child's ball may be fastened to the end of the rope so that it cannot bounce away, a devotee who surrenders to Krishna becomes tied to the rope of Vedic injunctions and is never lost in worldly affairs. In this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has quoted from the Rig Veda 1.156.3 as follows. Om Asya Janato Nama Chid Vivattan Mahaste Vishnu Sumatim Bhajamahe Om Tat Sat. O Vishnu, your name is completely transcendental. Thus it is self-manifest. Indeed, even without properly understanding the glories of chanting your holy name, if we vibrate your name with at least a small understanding of its glories, that is, if we simply repeat the syllables of your holy name, gradually we shall understand it. The supreme entity indicated by the pranava Om is Sat, or self-revealing. Therefore, even if one is disturbed by fear or envy, the transcendental form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead will become manifest to one who continues to chant the Lord's holy name. Further evidence is given in Srimad Bhagavatam 6.2.14. Sanketyam parihasyam va stobam helanam eva va vaikuntanam agrahanam asheshagaharam viduhu. One who chants the holy name of the Lord is immediately freed from the reactions of unlimited sins, even if he chants indirectly to indicate something else, jokingly, for musical entertainment, or even neglectfully. This is accepted by all the learned scholars of the scriptures.
Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadanti Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uta Pada Kamalam Sri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalitam Sri Vishakanvitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyaye Vacha Patitanam Pavane Bhyo Vaishnave Bhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo 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 Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna. So we are continuing discussions between Maharaj Nimi and the Navayogendras. And we have now come to the answer to the second question raised by Maharaj Nimi and the reply to that by Havir, one of the Navayogendras. And we see that these instructions that are given by the Navayogendras are so important that the disciples of Srila Prabhupada have thought it appropriate to give such an elaborate purport on each and every verse. And I remember once I was sitting in a class of His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami, and Maharaj was mentioning that throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada would refer to the commentaries of the previous acharyas and then give his Bhaktivedanta purports. And wherever the commentaries would be elaborate, then Srila Prabhupada would also give an elaborate purport. But where the commentary was very brief, Srila Prabhupada would not step over the acharyas and give a long purport, but just give a very short purport. So we can understand that the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada, have gone through the commentaries of the previous acharyas and then extracted the essence from the scriptures and then given such an elaborate purport. And it is really interesting to see how Srila Prabhupada, even towards the final days of his pastimes here in this world, as he was translating the Brahma Vimohan Leela, even there we see that Srila Prabhupada would give such elaborate purports. And what is most interesting is that actually Srila Prabhupada was in the final stages of his pastimes here in this world. And of course, he's an acharya, and whatever he says is absolutely the supreme truth. So he could have, if he so desired, given very short purports and then moved on to complete as much of the Srimad Bhagavatam as possible. But then Srila Prabhupada did not do that. He actually went through, you know, all the commentaries and then extracted the essence. And even though the purports were very lengthy, as we see in the Brahma Vimohan Leela, you know, Srila Prabhupada took it upon himself to write all this, or to give all this long purports. So this Nav Yogendras, so we see, are very special personalities. And this Nav Yogendras are actually the sons of Maharaj Rishabdev, who himself had 100 sons. And out of this 100 sons, it's described that 9 of the sons became Kshatriyas, and they were given the kingdom of the entire kingdom that Rishabdev ruled over. He divided into 9 different parts and gave it to each one of them. And Nav Yogendras became Mahabhagavats, Paramahamsa devotees. And the remaining 81 actually went on to study the scriptures in great detail, and then they went on to, you know, conduct a lot of fruitive activities and so on, and they became great brahmanas. So each and every one of the 100 sons of Maharaj Rishabdev were engaged as per their propensity and as per their inclination. And it's really interesting, because if you see from the pastime of Maharaj Rishabdev himself, he was the son of King Nabi and Meru Devi, and it's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam very elaborately that King Nabi, when he got Rishabdev as a son, and he was seeing how, because Rishabdev was an expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so he came already with so many of those qualities of the Supreme Personality. And Maharaj Nabi was actually very, very happy to see how Rishabdev was so much loved by all his all the subjects of the kingdom that Maharaj Nabi was ruling over. And at some point of time, when he found that Rishabdev had really settled down and he was ready to be taking over the throne, at that time Maharaj Nabi and Meru Devi just renounced everything, went to the forest, and then achieved the topmost perfection of their lives. And Maharaj Nabi actually happened to be the son of Maharaj Agnitra, who in turn was the son of Maharaj Priyavrat. So we see that the Nav Yogendras actually come from a very, very exalted lineage of great Paramhamsa devotees of the Lord. Right? And what is really interesting to see is that at the beginning of the pastime itself, Maharaj Parikshit is asking this question to Sukadeva Goswami, that how is it that Maharaj Parikshit, who was such a great devotee, actually got attached to family members who is a cause of bondage in this material world? So how is it that such a thing happened? Please explain to me. And who is asking this question? He is none other than Maharaj Parikshit, who himself was a great king and who himself was carrying out his responsibilities as a king and You know, he was married in the grastha ashram. So he understood fully well what are the entanglements of the grastha ashram, right? And he was not able to comprehend how Maharaj Priyavrat, I mean, such a great exalted soul who was actually in the Gandhamadana mountains and he was actually, you know, doing tapasya as per the instructions of his spiritual master Narad Muni. You know, he actually came down and took on this position of being the king. And then Sukadeva Goswami, answering the question of Maharaj Parikshit, says that, yes, what you're saying is right. Priyavrat Maharaj was not an ordinary person. He was a very, very exalted soul. And because he had taken shelter of the lotus feet of his spiritual master, Narad Muni, he was actually given full empowerment. He was actually able to perform his duties in perfect consciousness. And at the point of time when Swayambhu Manu saw that there was nobody to carry on the duties of a king, at that time he approaches Maharaj Priyavrat and requests him to be the king. And then Maharaj Priyavrat, you know, very humbly tells his father that, you know, because he understands that the order of his father could not be rejected, but still very humbly he puts forward that, I'm very much afraid that if I take on these responsibilities, then what would happen to my spiritual life? And it's very interesting to see here that actually Swayambhu Manu does not respond to that particular remark of Maharaj Priyavrat. He just keeps quiet. And Sukadeva Goswami continues to narrate to Maharaj Parikshit, saying how Brahmaji actually comes and explains to Priyavrat Maharaj about how it is important for him to perform his duty. So we see over here that right from the ancient times, how it is that a son, you know, even though his father may be giving him an instruction contrary to what he was actually having inclination for, the son was extremely respectful towards his father, right? And he did not reject whatever his father was saying. He accepted whatever his father was saying, but just put forward his own viewpoint, saying that, you know, I feel that I might be just getting myself attached. And Swayambhu Manu, of course, he himself was a great devotee of the Lord, and he was the emperor of the whole universe. And he was married. He had a wife, Shatarupa. He had Devahuti as his daughter. And in one sense, Swayambhu Manu, although he was such an exalted devotee of the Lord, we see from the pastimes of Kandamuni and Devahuti that he was also quite attached to his daughter. So when he brings his daughter and hands her over to Kardama Muni, as per the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, at that time when he is parting from his daughter, it's very nicely explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam that as a father, you know, who is handing over his daughter into the care of his son-in-law, so here, although he is a great devotee, Mahabhagavat Paramahamsa devotee of the Lord, still, you know, that affection that is there in his heart came out, and actually he started shedding tears because he could see that there was an imminent separation that was coming out between him and his daughter. So Swayambhu Manu was an exalted devotee, but he was also, you know, entangled with all the material obligations of an emperor. So he, you know, wanted Priyavrat to take over the responsibilities, and as it is explained, why he wanted to take over the responsibilities was because he had sufficient to do with the material world. And he understood that the material world, one cannot continue to prolong one's connection with the material world. At some point of time, we have to give it up. Because the material world is a source of bondage, however, whoever you may be in this material world. Right? So we will come to that particular point a little while later. But what I wanted to impress upon is how Priyavrat took on the instructions of his father and wanted to fulfill it, but then he expressed to his father in a very affectionate way that I don't think it is appropriate for me to be taking on these responsibilities. And if one sees the present generation, how they take on the instructions of their parents and how they are ready to follow the instructions of their parents. Till about 50-60 years back, I remember when I was a child, our parents or our grandparents were considered, I mean, they were our authorities, and whatever they said was absolutely the last word. And there was no question of us in any way or form going against what they said. But today, the present generation somehow considers it absolutely a norm not to be listening to their parents. Right? It's just a norm. And they feel that why should we listen to the parents? And that too, not when they reach an age where they are self-sufficient. One finds that they are doing this even when they are at a very young age, when they are like 13 and 14. Right? When they are still dependent on their parents, they feel that there is no need for us to listen to our parents. And why does one see such a behavior in the children? Right? If it is not actually the fault of the children. It is actually the fault of the parents. Because the parents themselves are leading a life of such a nature, they are themselves trying to gratify their senses to such an extent that the children are seeing that the fathers are no longer role models. Why should I listen to my parents? Because my parents, after all, are engaged in trying to gratify their senses. So in what way my behavior is different from what my parents are doing? Right, so this is the questions that they ask there. And invariably, the parents, they try to put pressure on their children, trying to make them to be what they are not being. And now particularly we are going through this season of examination results, and we are seeing in the newspapers there's so many instances of children who are committing suicides or running away from home. And why are they doing this? It's only because this is such a huge amount of pressure that is being put upon them by their parents to be what they are not wanting to be. Right? And somehow the educational system that we have in India is such that, you know, everything is dependent on a few hours. Your entire year's effort is all decided by a few hours, you know, sometime in the month of June, around this time of the year. And if for some reason you're not able to make it, then you have to waste 1 year. And more than anything else, because the parents have such an undue expectation from the child, when the child is not able to meet the expectation of the parents, then the child becomes completely frustrated. And you see that there are so many of this examples of suicides, and where the children leave home and get away from the clutches of their parents. So from this pastime of Maharaj Rishabhdev, where he had 100 children, we can see very, very wonderful example of how Maharaj Rishabhdev allowed each and every one of his 100 children to do exactly what they wanted. There was no pressure. It is not as if the Nav Yogendras, the nine sons of Rishabhdev, who became this Mahabhagwat Paramahamsa devotees, they were told by Maharaj Rishabhdev to become Nav Yogendras. No, it's just that they had this natural inclination. And it is so unfortunate that even in our association, in our society, we see sometimes where the children are put to such undue pressure by their parents. So on the one hand, we have out in the material world where the children are put to undue expectations and pressure in order to perform well in their examination and become, you know, somebody great in society. At the same time, sometimes we see in our own community of devotees that parents sometimes put such undue pressure on the child to become a devotee. Right? And it is so difficult for us to see sometimes when the child is brought very small, maybe 3 or 4 years of age, the child comes into a satsang, and then, you know, the parents very proudly, they tell the child, you know, chant Narsingha prayers or chant some other prayers or chant the shloka, right? Not understanding how much pressure this is putting on the child, right? Just imagine if one of us were asked to come before, a group of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, and we were told, give a Bhagavatam class, right? What would be our situation at that particular point of time? This is exactly what the child is also going through when it is told to come before a group of adults and told, you know, just sing Narsingha Aarti or sing, say some shlokas. The child is really put to so much of intense pressure. And gradually over a period of time we'll find that this child actually, he doesn't want to come anymore into the association of devotees. It's so unfortunate. We are of course very well meaning, we are trying our level best to make our child into a devotee, but we have to understand that our child is coming with its own karma. It is of course our responsibility to try and connect him to Krishna consciousness, try and connect him to the association of devotees, but beyond that, how much can we pressurize the child to become a devotee? It's actually violence to be doing this. Because over a period of time, when the child feels so much pressure to perform in the association of devotees, that he just loses the taste. And in fact, he hates the association of devotees. And he tells his parents at the point of time when he is in a position to rebel, which is around 15, 16 years of age, he tells his parents that, I'm sorry, I don't want to come anymore to a satsang program. And who has made this? Who did this to the child? It's us, parents. Putting that child under so much of pressure, putting him in a box and having so much of expectations from him. So if you see from the lives of all these great devotees of the Lord, we can see that they brought up their children in a way that they gave complete freedom to the child to decide what that child wanted to be. Even Maharaj Priyavrat, he had actually 10 sons. Out of which 7 sons, he gave them the kingdoms that he himself created. And then 3 of his sons became Mahabhagavat devotees. And then through another wife, he had actually 3 sons who later on became 3 Manus. So, these are just some examples in the scriptures of the devotees of the Lord who allowed their children to somehow or the other create their own future. And this is very, very important for us, particularly grihasthas, in the association, in a society like ISKCON, where we are bringing up our children, and of course we all would like our children to become Mahabhagavats like this Navayogendras. Why not? Right? But Srimad Bhagavatam explains so vividly through the pastime of Prahlad Maharaj. So what is it that the benediction that is given to Prahlad Maharaj? That 10 generations of your family before and after will go home back to Godhead. Right? So that's the benediction that is given to any practicing devotee. So why can't we think that if we become exemplary devotees of Krishna, then our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren will automatically get the benefit? Why do we not think like that and try to become exemplary ourselves rather than have these expectations from our children that they should become somebody like this Navayogendras? And our society has been unfortunately replete with so many such examples where immature understanding of the philosophy, immature understanding of the application of the philosophy has resulted in so many children who are actually who could potentially have the opportunity to practice Krishna consciousness have actually left the movement. Right? So, very wonderful pastime from where we can learn so many different lessons. So, today is also the disappearance day of Mukunda Dutt, and of course, it's Nan Yatra today. So Mukunda Datta was a very special devotee during the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's explained that he was actually a very close friend of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Nimai Pandit at that time. And Mukunda would often enter into debates with Nimai. And Nimai had, during the time when he was, you know, a teacher of grammar, he had this particular inclination to show off his knowledge, and he would get Mukunda and enter into a debate with him. And invariably, Mukunda would get defeated. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Mukunda were very dear friends. And one very wonderful pastime where Mukunda was actually a very important part of was this pastime where Gadadhar Pandit actually took initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi. It was Mukunda who told Gadadhar Pandit that there is this very wonderful devotee of the Lord and I would like you to come and meet him. And Gadadhar Pandit, naturally, because Gadadhar Pandit was a brahmachari, he was in the renounced order, so he was thinking when Mukunda told him that there is this very wonderful devotee, he assumed that this person would be a sannyasi or a brahmachari. So he accompanied Mukunda, and as they were approaching the house of Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Gadadhar Pandit started seeing how opulent the house of Pundarik Vidyanidhi was, and all sorts of doubts started coming in his mind. And as they entered into the house of Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Gadadhar Pandit was extremely surprised to see that Pundarik Vidyanidhi was actually lying down on a divan and he was chewing paan. He was very beautifully dressed in silken garments and he had his hair very beautifully combed, and periodically there would be somebody coming in front and showing him a mirror. And you know, so for all external reasons, Gadadhar Pandit thought that here is a person who is completely attached to material sense gratification. And he was wondering, why is it that Mukunda has brought him to me? I mean, why has Mukunda brought me to him? So he was just not able to comprehend. And then Mukunda, understanding Gadadhar Pandit's heart, suddenly started singing a bhajan from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And as this bhajan was going on, Pundarik Vidyanidhi's entire behavior completely transformed. And Pundarik Vidyanidhi went into such ecstasy that it is described that for 4 hours, Pundarik Vidyanidhi, even 6 men could not hold him together. You know, all his beautiful attire, everything went all over the place. His hair was completely messed up. And he was actually in real transcendental ecstasy. And that was the time when Gadadhar Pandit realized, yes, that this, here is a person who is actually a pure devotee of Krishna. And Gadadhar Pandit was so much filled with remorse that later on he took initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi. And there's one more pastime of Mukunda. During the time when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was narrating, was giving audience to the devotees during that 21 hours Satprahar Leela. At that time, all the devotees were in the association of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but Mukunda, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, I don't want to see this person, Mukunda. So the devotees were bewildered because they knew that Mukunda was actually very dear to the Lord. Some of the devotees went outside and told Mukunda, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord does not want to meet you. So Mukunda said, please ask the Lord when he would be ready to meet me. And then when the devotees went and asked the Lord, Lord said that I am ready to meet him after 10 million births. You go and tell him that I am ready to meet him only after 10 million births. So the moment Mukunda heard that the Lord is ready to meet him after 10 million births, he started actually jumping in ecstasy. And then when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to know about it, he realized the qualities of Mukunda, and then, you know, he approached him and then gave him his association. So Mukunda was a very wonderful devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then today, of course, is Snan Yatra. Today is a day where Lord Jagannath actually has his bath. And there's a very beautiful pastime in this connection where one of our devotees actually was very skeptical. And it's described that after the bath that is given to the Lord with a lot of water, the Lord actually develops fever. Right? And then for the next couple of weeks, he actually goes into seclusion to recover from his fever, and there's a lot of medicines and you know, a lot of herbs that are given to the Lord at that time. And one of our devotees actually was quite skeptical. He was thinking to himself, oh, is it really true that the Lord gets fever? So, he wanted to actually, and he was a doctor by profession, so he actually wanted to see, you know, so he went over there and, you know, he approached the panda and told the panda that I don't think that the Lord has fever. I'm a doctor, I'm a physician, so, you know, if the Lord has fever, then the Lord's forehead must be hot, because that is the normal, way in which the fever manifests. So this panda was actually very angry with this devotee, and he said, how dare you doubt that the Lord is having fever? But anyway, since you say that you're a physician, I will take you to the Lord and you can touch the forehead of the Lord and see for yourself. And then this person actually went and touched the forehead of the Lord, and lo and behold, the forehead was actually hot. So today is the day where the Lord actually goes into seclusion, and then of course it's a whole month of festivals, and then we have the Rath Yatra, and then we have the Ulta Rath Yatra. So it's a very auspicious month for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, all of us for whom Lord Jagannath is a manifestation of that particular form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that resides in Jagannath Puri. So for us, you know, this month is extremely auspicious and holy, and a lot of our devotees go to Jagannath Puri for the Rath Yatra also from here. So every day we would be having this beautiful narration which was sung by Akinchan and Krishna Prabhu today. It began the beautiful bhajan that we sang today, and every day in the morning we would be having it for the next couple of weeks. Hare Krishna. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Akinchana Krishna Prabhu? Yes.
Hare Krishna. You know, as you were saying about children and parents, that how parents may sometimes force the children to do some things. But it is seen that even though the parents may not in a gross way put any pressure on the children, but still the parents have their expectations. You know, my son should, become an engineer, and he should also go abroad. And they may not express it, but amongst their relatives or amongst themselves, they may be talking, and that the children are hearing. And even though the parents are not telling the children anything, which is that, you know, they have that expectation. Dekho, ye padosi ka beta kitna pad likha hai. And then the son, he knows that he is not like that, and he feels very disappointed, and then finally he feels that he cannot match with the expectations of his parents, and then, you know, he goes and does something unexpected. So how to in that situation, what do you do? Suppose a parent may not externally or on a gross way put pressure, but still they have their expectations, and that gets known to the children. You know, children can sense the vibration.
So I remember reading a book about 40 years back. So this book was something on parenting, although it was not exactly on parenting. And one of the things that this book was trying to emphasize on was how important it is for us to tell our children that we don't have any expectations from them. Because the nature of parents is that they always subtly or otherwise, you know, give the child an indication of what is there in their hearts, right? And it keeps coming up periodically. There's no way by which that cannot be done. So, because it's a natural affection of the parents. But in order to counter that, that book was saying how important it is for parents to genuinely tell their children that they don't have any expectations from them, and they love the child irrespective of whether the child is meeting their expectations or not. So on the one hand, there is, even though you may not say it very subtly, you may not say it very grossly, that you are having expectations from your child, but you know, from the body language and all that, the child is seeing that. So periodically, if the parents make it a point to tell the child, you know, like you get the child in front of you and have a very loving exchange with him and then tell him that, my dear son, you know, irrespective of whatever happens, whatever you do in your life, remember one thing, my love for you will be the same. And if you say it with all feeling, all genuinity in your heart, for sure, the child will understand 100%, right? And then, you know, you will see how the child actually develops in his own personal life. And I think, I read this book very accidentally 40 years back when I was not yet a parent. But what that book told me, and it told me, it also gave another very important lesson that all parents must do. And that is to hug the child. Right? Hugging, not just children, even, why is it God brothers and God sisters hug each other? Right? Because it is an expression of love. It's an expression of affection. And it is a physical expression of affection which we very rarely do, thinking that it is actually a show of weakness. But it's not. So this particular book was giving me these two lessons. One is, you tell the child that you have no expectations from him or her. And second is, make it a point to hug that child at least once a day. Alright? So, and a child is always a child, right? Even though he might be 30 years of age, he might be 40 years of age, right? He's still your child. So if we follow these two principles, right, in our own lives, with regard to our children, right, for sure, our relationship with our child will remain intact. Irrespective of what subtle expectations we may give to the child, still, the relationship will remain intact. And more than anything else, the child will rise up to the level of its abilities. Right? And of course, you know, it's foolishness or gross illusion to think that if a child has got the capacity of a Maruti car, right, by putting a Mercedes engine in it, you know, it's going to drive at 200 miles an hour. Right? It will fall apart. A Maruti car is meant to be driven at 60 miles an hour. But just by giving it all sorts of external inputs, you know, sending him to coaching classes and sending him to, you know, making, you know, to swim, to this college, to the best college in the country and, you know, the most expensive college, is in no way actually going to increase the capacity of the child beyond a particular limit. Right? So this is also very important for the parents to understand, what is the capacity of my child? Yes.
Another aspect of the question is, how much authority does the parents have in deciding the wife of the son? Like, for example, if the son falls in love, say maybe with a girl out of the community, maybe even a Catholic or say maybe a Muslim, he wants to get married to a girl. So how much authority do the parents have in telling him, no, you should not? Or can the son make his own decision?
In today's present day and age, I would say that seeing how marriages are failing left, right and center, if a boy and a girl are willing to take the responsibility for their marriage, full responsibility, right? And if they are ready to commit themselves to this marriage for the rest of their lives, I would say that it's actually, you should just give them your full blessings. Because where the parents have interfered in the lives of their children to get them married, it is not necessary that all those marriages have been very successful. Right? Of course, it's not also very necessary that all marriages where the children have selected their own spouse has also been successful. Right? But the difference is that when the children are deciding to get married, they are taking full responsibility for their marriage. Right? And at the end of the day, they are grown up adults and they have full faculties to take the decision. So we just allow them and give them full blessings. Right? So that's my understanding of today's scenario with regard to marriages, because gone are the days where the parents were living with the children and provided a support system to the children, where in the event that the boy and the girl had some differences, the parents would step in and try to resolve that for them. Right? Today it's all a nuclear family. The parents are living separately, the children are living separately. So where is that support system? So if the parents are taking the decision for the child, right, and the marriage is successful, wonderful. Right? But who made that marriage wonderful? It's a couple. Right? The parents have connected the boy and the girl to each other based upon the community, whatever. Right? But who worked on the marriage to make it successful? The couple. Right? So even in such a situation, that couple had to take the full responsibility for their marriage. So I would say that both are wonderful, both the situations are in a country like India, it's nice to have with the parents, you know, make the marriage of the boy and the girl and provide a support system for the boy and the girl to make their marriage work, right? Or if the boy and the girl were to take their decision on their own and take full responsibility for their decision, both are wonderful. Yes.
And third aspect is, suppose if the person who has been selected by the son is totally detested by the parents, and if the parents put a condition saying that if you get married according to how you want, then you will not get a share of our property, something like that. Is that wrong if the parents do that? I mean, he gives permission to the son that you get married, no problem, but you will not live in the house, you live separately, you live on your own. Is that right on the parents' side? Can he exercise his right, the parents' right? Because we cannot live with maybe this girl or this, you know, especially if it's a boy marrying a girl, then with this girl in our house, because of our community, our conservative people, and they will all oppose. So you live separately, you make your own living, you have got nothing to do with us. You have my blessings, but you be independent. Is that the right thing to do? Can the parents exercise their right by saying like
that? Finally, at the end of the day, I would say that the money that has been made by me out of my own hard work, right? What I want to do with that money is my call, right? I may want to give it to charity, I may want to give it to Krishna, right? And if according to my wisdom, I consider that the person that my son is marrying is actually not a fit person for that person to get married to, right? And it's very likely that my son could just say, okay, dad, to hell with your money, to hell with you, I'm getting married to this girl, right? Because I love her and I'm taking full responsibility for the marriage, right? And we've seen so many situations like that happen, and where the marriages are extremely successful. So there's no hard and fast rule, right? But for sure, if a person has earned his money and you know, whatever he wants to do with his money is his call. He may want to give it to his son, he may want to give it to Krishna, he may want to give it to some other charity, right? There's nothing. The Hindu Succession Act, actually, is very interesting. The Hindu Succession Act says very clearly that in the lifetime of a person, the children do not have any claim to that person's wealth, right? And he can do with it whatever he wants, which means that suppose you know, I'm a very wealthy person and I'm a son's and I'm squandering my wealth, right? My son cannot go to the court saying that this man is squandering his wealth, which eventually would be coming to me. The Hindu Succession Act says that the son has got no right to the property of the father, so far as the prophet father is alive, which means the father could just squander all his wealth and his son couldn't do anything about it. So the law also recognizes that. So Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. The question answer session went longer than the class, so it was nice.